Hello, Austin. Hello, Ben. Good morning. I'm David Murkowski. I'm from Frog Design in San Francisco. I'm here to talk about the future of television. Supermodality. So, television. Let's just start with some stats. About 99% of Americans have a television, at least one. 66% have at least three, and my hotel room had two. I have no idea why. The average amount of time that we spend having the television on in our house is 7 hours and 40 minutes. That doesn't mean we're watching it for that long. That just means it's on. So we're watching the Weather Channel or music or news. If you actually do distill down, though, how much time people watch television, the average American above the age of six watches television for 4 hours a day. That's 28 hours a week. That's 1,500 hours a year. For comparison, the average child goes to school for 900 hours a year. Television is an extremely powerful cultural force. You shouldn't mess with television. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. The problem is that it's broken. It's increasingly broken for the kid on the right. He's growing up in a world where the internet is the major form of mass media. And the internet is all about control and choice. Unlike the guy on the left who grew up with TV as the major form of mass media, who expects TV to work how it does. We have names for these people at Frog, and the guy on the left is called the Massive Passive, and the kid on the right is the Tragically Equipped. Here are some more Tragically Equipped's. The one thing, though, both audiences share in common when they watch TV is that their brain shuts down. It's not entirely fair. Obviously, the entire brain is still working, but what I'm talking about is actually the neocortex. So I'm going to divide the brain up into two pieces. 99% of it I'm going to call the lower brain, and then the 1% of it I'm going to call the higher brain, the neocortex. And just to give you a sense of that, if I were to take the neocortex out of your brain and flatten it on this table, it would be about as deep as a handkerchief and about as wide as long as well. So it's a very small part of your brain, and it's recently evolved specifically because you're a human. And when you're watching TV, that human side of you kind of shuts down. You become a reptile. Why? Well, because essentially you're being overstimulated. You ever laid in a field and the sun is shining, it's bright like yesterday, and it close your eyes and it comes through and you have those rainbow effects on your eyes and it gets all nice and soft and suddenly you're asleep. Well, that's the same thing that TV is doing. It's basically radiant light, unreflected, beaming through your retina, even when your eyes are closed, triggering a chemical response that stimulates the pleasure center in your brain. It hypnotizes you into a low energy state. We like that. That's why we watch TV. And that's okay. It's good. Watching TV is the same as staring at the sun. When I say television, I mean the box television. Today, I'm not talking about Web 2.0 video networks. I'm not talking about VO or Juiced or Rever or YouTube or any of those guys. Anything that happens in the browser window. I'm talking about TV the box. So to help me understand who you are, how many of you, if you could just raise your hands, the only question I'll ask today, how many of you watch TV through one of these kinds of boxes? An enormous amount of you. Those who don't probably download it legally through iTunes, I'm sure, or maybe you torrent it or got it from some friends, or maybe you bought it on a DVD or got it through Netflix. The point isn't really where you got it. The point is that we're able to ask that question at all. A couple of years ago, we couldn't ask that question. We would all be watching TV through a box or antenna, which is essentially the same thing as a box. And now I know there's a lot of you right now who are priding yourself saying, well, I don't watch TV at all. I count myself among you. I feel that pride too. I don't watch TV. In our research, people have no idea what this box does. They think it's like a hot water cooler or heater, right? Just something you plug in and you forget it. In fact, they think the TV is the TV. And it makes sense. They can't be faulted. You point the remote control at the TV and it changes the TV. Makes sense? So that's what I do at Frog. I focus on how that TV changes. I focus on the television user interface. And in our industry, they have a great name for that. It's called the 10-foot UI. And that's because presumably I'm 10 feet away from the TV when I'm watching it. And they also have 2-foot UIs. This right here is a 2-foot UI. And they also have 2-inch UI, something like this. So I designed for 10-foot UIs. I've done this for BBC, MTV, TiVo, Intel, and most recently for a company named OpenTV, whose product I'm here to talk about today. OpenTV is not a household name. You can't go out and buy an OpenTV. However, they do power over 75 million TVs around the world in 92 countries. They write the software that lives in the box that connects the media to the screen. They power television. But they were missing a crucial piece of software. It's called an EPG, another industry term, Electronic Programming Guide. And they asked Frog to make one for them. The problem with current EPGs, if you guys are familiar with EPGs, you probably have them on your television, right? You press the guide button, it's a grid, and you navigate around and choose something to watch. The problem with those EPGs is that they're not scalable for the massive video being generated today. They're linear, they're based in time. And they've been doing this for quite some time. Here's the very first guide ever printed. 65 years ago, July 5th, 1941. It came out from NBC. And you can see that it was actually based on a week. There was that little programming available. And because NBC knew who had TVs, because so few people had them, they would actually mail these to you. And then you would know what's on for TV for the week. And what's awesome is that on the back was a survey. And it asked you what you wanted to watch more of. And so presumably you would check box things off like amateur boxing and send it back. And then the networks would update and they would produce more amateur boxing and then show it to you. And that's awesome. That's social TV 65 years ago. It's kind of a Netflix model, though, very slow. We still don't have this today. Fast forward 10 years, and here's a copy of the first television guide. This is actually TV Guide itself. It's the first one that actually shows you it in grid form. That is, it organizes channels on the left, time up on the top, and you're pretty familiar with these. You should be. This was 1952, and fast forward to today, and nothing's changed. This is the most current EPG out there on the market. It's Microsoft, and it's shipping with AT&T's new digital system. And it's the same as it was back in the day, 1950s. State of the art, and it's quickly becoming extinct because of these guys, the Web 2.0 video networks, because what they can do is give you non-linear TV. That is, it's not organized by time. You can find what you want to watch based on interest, tags, related, friends, and ultimately you have infinite choice. The one thing they lack, though, as if any of you have used these, and I imagine we all have, is the televisual sense of the medium. It's another word in the industry, and televisual refers to the quality of TV on the box, which is edge-to-edge, full-screen, immersive, very engaging mode of watching television. These Web 2.0 video networks instead have checkboxes and lists and tags and banner ads and IM windows that pop up. And it makes it very difficult to become immersed in them. And so these apps aren't really television, but they're getting better. And if you've looked at Juiced in any way, you see where this is going. It's a tremendous improvement towards creating the televisual experience. So this is what the industry of TV on the box is worried about. That these apps one day might grow to simulate the televisual experience online, and that the tragically equipped will in large part bail on television, as we know it, on the box. And so that's what OpenTV asked us to do, is essentially to make them relevant. Because if they're not, then the next time I ask that question, how many of you watch TV on the box, there'll be a lot less hands in the air. So today I'm going to talk about a framework for designing 10-foot user interfaces for two audience types, massive passives, tragically equipped, both of whom are staring at the sun, essentially, and have access to this infinite choice. But before I get into that, I'm going to actually show you the demo. That way, if you have another panel you want to go to, you get the pretty pictures up front, and you can stick around for the theoretical afterwards. So the system that I'm going to show you today is called Mondrian. Okay, how far can I go? That far. It'll be interesting. So this is the problem with TV, the box, and the screen, right? Normally I'd point it that way, but the box is actually over. So TV, I'm watching it. And I press on my remote control channel up, and I'm watching another TV channel. And I move through those TV channels pretty fluidly using channel up. That's primarily how we've been taught to do it, right? Yeah, channel up, channel up, channel up, and that's called surfing. This demo, though, takes a different approach. Instead of going channel up, it actually uses what's on the remote control called a four-way, right? Up, down, left, and right. And so what I can do when I'm watching TV like this is just press the up button. And what it does is it brings up a margin. And that margin basically shows me what else is on TV right now in a list, left to right, and gives me a preview of what I could watch on top. So if I select, I would be watching Jazz Masters on MTV. Instead, I'm just going to press down. By pressing down, I return immediately back to watching what I was. It's basically a preview. It's kind of like picture in picture, right? So when a commercial comes on, I can browse around, find what I want. So that's the what's on right now. The cool thing is I can press left and see what's in my library. So it's like TiVo, things that I've saved. And it shows me in this column things perhaps that I've most recently saved. And I can press OK onto this one, and it goes ahead and actually changes my focus. So now, without going into an extended menu of options, I'm watching something that I recorded maybe a couple days ago. In this case, a film called Elephant's Dream. So I'm sure you're probably guessing where this is going. That's right, I can press down, and there's another margin menu. And in this case, it's a little dark to see. You see an advertisement there, of course, because it's TV. And what I can do is choose a scene from what I'm watching. So it's kind of like DVD menus, and I can choose whichever one I want to watch. And again, I see sort of a preview of what's to come beneath it. And I can just press up if I don't want to. Again, returning back to center focus. And then finally, I can press right and see recommendations. So those are the four edges of the screen. The broadcast, the library on the left, the scenographic on the bottom, and the recommendations on the right. And I can choose a recommendation and go into it. So I'm going to show you what that looks like. It's going to break. I'm going to tell you that right now. This demo has failed to stay current. But I'll try my best, and maybe later we'll restart it and see. So what I can do on any one of these margins is press right again. And now I go full screen into a recommendations grid. So behind every single margin is a grid, which gives me more choice. So this isn't just about those margins. It's actually about these grids that live behind these margins. And the margins just give me a very short choice selection set. So I can move around. If there was audio on this thing, you'd be hearing Elephant's Dream. You can see the demo is choking. I can move up. I can move around, basically, in this system. It's kind of like a fractal, kind of nonlinear. Basically, every direction, up, down, left, right, is mapped to some metadata vector. So here you're seeing the video for Crazy by Gnarls Barkley. And if I go right, you'll see that that's the performance of Crazy on Letterman. So users can basically browse associatively in this system. If I press OK on any media object, I'm returned full screen to watching that media. I go back. So I'll show you another margin that leads to a grid. I can press up, and then up again. And now I'm into the broadcast grid. Again, I apologize, it's dark, it's hard to see. But behind the broadcast margin was the broadcast grid. And so I can browse around, I get live previews of what's on television. up above each channel. You see we've actually flipped the axis so that time's on the left now, channels are on top, and that's because we want to take advantage of that HD screen real estate. And all you see probably here is Dewsgate finals, but you have to trust me, there's lots of other words up there in that grid. I can press OK, and now I'm watching something else, just like you would in a normal guide. At any time, I can press the info key. And the info key brings up basically what we call a media card. It's the info layer. It's the metadata about what it is that I'm watching. So it tells me title, duration, things like that. And there are two functions up there, save and filter. And they're on the left and the right. And the reason is because if I were to press left right now, it would save that media into the full screen grid hiding behind the margin of my library. And if I were to press right, it would filter it. It would recommend it for me on that grid that I showed you before where I was navigating fractally, like the Gnarls Barkley video. So I'll actually do save right now. I'll press left. And sure enough, it went and saved it over into the broadcast and the library. So let me show you that. I press left, double click, basically, through the margin and into the grid. And there I am. This is kind of like your TiVo library, but instead of it being a text list, it's actually all visual video previews. And over there on the right, if you saw the Dew skateboarding, whatever it was, appeared. Sure enough, it's stored inside my library. And I'm able to move around and find something to select. So the really cool thing about this system is that anytime I can press back, no matter where I am, and instantly be watching television. You are not stuck in nested menus. You are not stuck in any mode. So just another example, I go up to the broadcast grid, double click, up, up, move around. And one cool thing also I can do in the system is select a channel itself as opposed to a media on that. A lot of brands right now are feeling like they're being disaggregated by the Web 2.0 video network, so this was a kind of token to them. And so I could also bring up that info card on the brand, and I can actually get, by pressing right, recommendations off of the brand of ESPN. And now it's showing me the recommendations grid entirely based on ESPN content with the most recommended thing in the center. So I... Yeah, so the size is all basically a linear fall off. So the most recommended thing is in the center, and the things that are up, down, left, and right are the second level of recommendation. And then as you kind of go out to the edge, it becomes less and less and less recommended. So I can press OK, and now I'm watching the soccer game. And let's say this was a previously recorded soccer game. I can press down, look at the scenographic menu, that is the highlights of the game. It could just be timestamps. It could be if there's a social layer to this, what people are watching. And I can press down again and go into a full screen mode and see basically all the scenes. You can imagine this working for movies as well. Again, just like DVD chapter menus. I press OK, and I'm watching television again. So the recommendations are powered by what's called an anticipation engine. And the anticipation engine takes in three variables. It takes in the content that you watch, clearly. It knows what you're watching, so it sort of stores that. And then it takes in the behavior, so when do you watch it? At night, at morning, do you watch things all together, sitcoms, things like that. And then it takes in the environment. What time of day is it? What season is it? Who's in the room with you, if we have that information? And you basically store a profile. So that profile is obviously a lot of complex things put together, but ultimately it's an individual profile custom to you. And the first set of recommendations on the right-hand side is from the whole system. So it's its own thing. Mm-hmm.
And who gets access to that profile?
Who wants access to their profile?
Everybody.
Exactly. So that's the system in a nutshell. Just to take you back through it in case there's any confusion, you have four margins. On top, you have a broadcast margin on the left. You have a library margin on the bottom. You have a scenographic margin on the right. You have a recommendations margin. And then behind each of those, you have a full screen grid. You would never see this interface on television. This is the exploded skeleton view to explain it. But behind each one is a full screen grid. And that, taken all together, is the system called Mondrian. Thank you. So the demo you saw was put together. Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
In your
So, yes, obviously advertising is a big deal on television, and once you have this one-to-one profile television system, it's a lot easier to do that targeting, and so that is the presumption of the system. We are working on the advertising side of it, though. That we have what? No, it's not out in the market yet. But yes, there are people we're talking to. Any other questions? Yeah. By the... Just unpack the word platform for me. Are you talking about the hardware reference platform or something else? So the application, it is an application that sits on top of a middleware and head-end stack from OpenTV. That's what they create. It's called Core. And this is basically a UI layer, an application layer on top of Core. Does that answer that? Okay. Okay. So, is that a half question? So this demo that you saw was put together last year in August. We're actually weeks away from completing a major update to this demo that's been incorporating user and industry feedback. So actually, if you have any of that feedback, please see me and maybe we can get it in. We're actually going to be showing this in a couple weeks at NAB. So if you want to swing by the National Association of Broadcasters, we'll be there showing the new one. It includes search, which I'm sure was something on everybody's mind. It includes a much more realistic recommendations grid, the one I showed you that's kind of fractal, scared some people. We added personal media as well. The central system and the interaction model is still the same. We've just made some major adjustments to the look and feel of it to make it easier to read and more obvious and a little bit more traditional. We've also got rid of a lot of the 3D effects in the cube that was making a lot of people dizzy, may have confused some of you what was happening, so we did that for both the side margins and the bottom margins. So anyway, that'll be at NAB in a couple weeks. And it should come to market next year, if all goes well. But today I'm going to be focusing on the product as it stands, not the updates. So let me step back and explain two central constructs of this demo. ZUIs, Zoomable User Interfaces, and Supermodality. So Mondrian actually resides on a two-dimensional flat surface. The system maps media to that surface. It actually puts media into the right grid depending upon its use. The user decodes that meaning based upon where it is in that grid. And in that sense, it's geographic. They understand where things are in relation to the surface. So things that are on the west are things they've saved, and things that are on the east are things that are recommended. You can think of this as kind of hunting and gathering 21st century style, right? Like the way we used to know there are berries in the north, and so we would head up north to go get berries. Well, now there's time. Broadcast grid is up north, and so we go to see what's on right now by going up north. So navigation, discovery, and retrieval become much easier when we cluster media together like this. So this is a ZUI, but wait, you say. There's no zooming, there's no depth, there's no in and out, back and forth. If you were at Asa Raskin's talk yesterday, you might have seen a lot of examples of that kind of dimensional zooming. Well, it's a common misunderstanding. There's another feature of ZUIs that are equally important, and that's panning, moving around left, right, up, and down. And what I argue is that ZUIs aren't so much about bringing depth, moving in and out, as it is about bringing perspective to the interface. That is, they engender a point of view. So two-dimensional movement suggests a camera was literally placed above that surface. And that gives you a sense of the surface because you're higher up. And so ZUIs, as an interaction model, orient you the way a camera or an eye might in the world. So how come ZUIs haven't been employed too often? Well, one, designers are often seductively tricked by them. They think they're hot, they're cool, they're the new thing, and they try to do that depth stuff. And engineers generally just laugh at them. The second problem is that the physical affordances, the actual types of input, are very hard to navigate depth, right? Most of the interfaces that we work with, like this mouse or this phone, they're two-dimensional. We don't really have good affordances for moving in and out of space. So if you avoid the seduction of the first problem, right, if you actually don't try to communicate depth in your interface, then the second problem is right under your nose or in your pocket. It's this thing. You're probably wearing one of these right now, maybe two, maybe three. They're standard on every single phone and every single consumer electronics device, almost every consumer electronics device. What is it called? It's got a whole bunch of names. It's cross-pad, D-pad, four-way, five-way, the controller. There really isn't a standard for it. I call it the four-way. You can call it what you want. And because I'm curious, I wanted to find out where it came from. Because it had to come from somewhere, right? I mean, someone had to make it at one point. So this is the only other question of the session for you. Does anyone know where this came from? Where? As a control, that's something that you push. I heard something say Pac-Man. Atari, Pac-Man. You guys are really close. That's great. It's actually Nintendo. And here it is. This is the artifact. This is the Game & Watch series Donkey Kong device. And it was the first time that the four controls for up, down, left, and right had been integrated into one single control. Before that, there were joysticks. There were trackballs. But they did not formally represent the directional movement that they afforded. That is, you did not look at them and say, oh, that means I can move up, down, left, and right. And in fact, joysticks went through a number of permutations where they were originally up, down, left, and right, and then they became all the eight directions, the diagonals, and then they became analog. It doesn't tell you what it can do. I'm making a big deal out of this for a reason. The predecessors to these were actually just, besides joysticks, were just buttons, right? Like on Pac-Man, you would just have a button for left and a button for right and a button for up and a button for down. And that made it a little bit more difficult to play. You had to move your thumb around those buttons. But when this device came out in 1975, some brilliant engineer had an innovation and said, let's merge the four together and put them on a rocker switch. So a single switch allows you to move in the cardinal directions up, down, left, right. So, and here's the key term, it embodies the cardinality of control in its design. And look at this. This is still with us. It's just that good. The DS, Nintendo's current flagship portable product, is freakily similar to the original Donkey Kong Game & Watch series. Even when you have touchscreen, vibration, microphone, and a stylus, that four-way controller still makes sense. And actually, on the right-hand side there, you'll see the kind of other buttons, the soft keys, the A, B, X, and Y. They're more abstract. Again, they don't embody any interaction. They are mapped to interfaces. They don't suggest anything. So all TV remote controls have these four-way controllers, and you'll see they've actually diverged a little bit and separated it off of the rocker switch, but they still, if you look closely at the design of these things, they still indicate whether it's wedges or separations or padding, they suggest, they embody their cardinality. And in fact, TiVo, who I contend is probably the best remote up there, still keeps it on a rocker switch because they do understand that it's all about basically embodying it in a single control. My favorite, by the way, in the bottom left is called the Battle Axe. That's AT&T's remote for their home zone service. They grafted a keyboard onto the top of it to deal with a search problem. Don't do this. So I've shown a lot of images of tech and gadgets and stuff like that, and I need to remember this is all about being human. This is my child. His name's Huxley Beauregard, and I miss him. And about a month after he was born, he started reaching towards objects. He started reaching towards me, and I just found that amazing. It totally floored me. And I remember saying to myself, my God, he's trying to affect his intention on the world. Yes, I actually said that. I'm a geek. He's able to coordinate his hand and his eye movement together. And what cognitive scientists understand is that the sensitive parts of your forefinger and your thumb are wired to your brain in the exact same way that the retina of the eye is. We are built this way for hand-eye coordination. It's why it happens within 4 to 5 weeks of a baby being born. We wouldn't survive otherwise. It's also why the airline industry for over 50 years has designed its instrument panels to reflect or embody the controls and the things on the outside of the plane. So for instance, the flaps of a plane are actually designed to be moved like flaps in the instrument panel. The more common one we've seen is the landing gear. And you see the big lever that is the landing gear, right? Well, the reason for that is because the pilots can't see the wheels. They need to feel the wheels from inside. And this gets us into cybernetics and the extension of man. It's when you get hit by a car and you say, they hit me. It's because you and the car are one and the same. You feel it. And that sense of feeling is what the four-way control is all about. It allows you to, new age term, feel the television. Keeps your eyes up on the TV while your hand is down and allows you to steer it. And that's critical, because you don't want to take your eyes away and look down at something to interact with it. Otherwise, you break the televisual experience. So that's one way of dealing with a problem of choice. The word for this, also another big word out there, is cognitive interoperability. Yeah, it's how we understand from hardware to software. That is, it maps the gestures that I'm performing directly onto the screen. A lot of people have remarked that Mondrian is actually like entering a bunch of cheat codes, right? Up, up, down, left, right, down, up. And that actually sounds pretty good to me, because this game was quite fun. And that's all it was doing, Dance Dance Revolution. And it had this, up, down, left, right. And so instead of your hands mapping, it was your feet mapping to the interface on the screen. So again, eyes up, in this case, feet down. And you were dancing, and you saw yourself dancing on screen. Again, you felt the television. And if you look at your feet when you dance, you're not dancing. So one last point before I move off of ZUIs. ZUIs are often contrasted to GUIs. For obvious reasons, they rhyme. But ZUIs actually aren't like GUIs. ZUIs are a class of GUIs. They're a kind of GUI. And there's another kind of GUI out there called WIMP. Aren't these names great? EPG, WIMP, ZUI, GUI. So WIMP stands for Windows Icon Menu Pointer. It's also the generalized computing model. It's what you and I and everybody else use in this world every day, and it looks like this, which is really too bad. WIMP has taken on a kind of holy stature in this industry, mostly because it is the dominant historical user interface. It kind of came about with Xerox PARC. We know the whole story with Apple and the Lisa, and Microsoft stole it and whatever. But point is, it's around, it's here, and it's hard to shake loose. It's almost as if we can't think about interface without thinking this way. And it's why we're all so amazed when the iPhone or the Wii come out. We're like, that can't possibly work. Doesn't have windows or icons or menus or pointers. It challenges our assumptions, because we're also trained to look at WIMPs as reality. So the reason I bring all of this up is because I contend that they don't work for TV. For starters, there's no pointing device on a TV. When there's no pointing device, UI management, that is windows and controls and checkboxes and lists and scroll bars, become very difficult. Second, I think icons are far too abstract. This is a running set of Vista icons. I think it's about 1/5 of the total set. Icons are extremely abstract. They don't really work well at 10-foot distances. They have to be very large. And in order to work, and they also really benefit from having a pointer. Your question? I will get to that. All the baggage of drag and drop and moving and clicking from WIMP really doesn't work on a TV. So anyway, the point is that WIMPs are going to lose to ZUIs one day, maybe not today. And really, when I say ZUI, I don't necessarily mean it has to be ZUI. I just mean something other than WIMP. I just really like ZUIs. I think they work well. I think we've tested them out a bit. We're starting to see a lot more talk about them these days, especially as the affordances, the control input devices become more available. When you look at another great example of a ZUI is the iPhone web browser, right? When you double click or whatever and you zoom into it and you zoom back. So we're starting to see these things enter the mass market. So it may be some other interface style, but the point is WIMPs are on their way out. And just look at any smartphone, right? I mean, that's basically a WIMP grafted onto a phone. Doesn't work. So that kind of wraps up ZUI. I'm going to start talking about supermodality. It should be only a couple more minutes, and then open up for questions. Supermodality is kind of hard to describe. It's not very well described by this image. But maybe if you stare at it long enough, it will. I probably should have just left this image up the whole time. So in order to describe supermodality, let me take a step back and describe just plain old vanilla modality and see if we can get it from there. So we mostly understand modality as this, these dialogue boxes, modal dialogue boxes. We hate these things. They prevent us from doing what we want to do. They're interruptions to our flow. The other way we understand modality are things called wizards. Poor, poor Clippy. It's amazing how much this guy has become the joke of interface design. So, in a human-computer interaction perspective, modes, plain old vanilla modes, are shared context between me and this screen, or any screen, for exchanging meaning and intent. So modes are not the interface themselves. What you're looking at is not the mode, but the context that the interface exists in. So when you're in a Word document like this and you press the letter M, the mode that you're in will put the letter M on the document. Makes sense. But when you move into the Windows Vista desktop and you press the letter M, doesn't type the letter M. It actually selects the first object that starts with the letter M. So that's a mode. So those are two different modes of using the computer. Jeff Raskin, human-computer interface extraordinaire, this is his definition for modal. The current state of the interface is not the user's locus of attention, and the interface will execute one among several different responses to the gesture depending on the system's current state, right, whatever that means. It means modal interfaces expect the user to do something in a certain way. The designers build it to perform to what their expectations of your actions are going to be. And when you fail to do what they intended, it gives you a modal dialog box. It gives you an error. And that's why they suck. So Mondrian is totally modal, though. Right? Your locus of attention is on the center there, on that guy's bald head. You're watching TV. And then you bring out a margin, and all of a sudden, your locus of attention is shifted to the right-hand side. It's also modal because each gesture that you perform, each up, down, left, and right, is completely dependent upon which grid state you're in. So when I'm up in the broadcast grid and I'm moving around those tables, those boxes and columns. When I'm over on the right-hand side, I'm still moving up, down, left, and right, but instead it's bringing all this data into me and it's surfing around in a whole different way. So each interface is extremely different. So I want to be clear, Mondrian is modal. Users are trapped in the process that we designed for them. And luckily, because we're Frog, we hire good designers. So it shouldn't be that bad. So it may be unclear. So let's use one last analogy. Modality. This is modality. It's also a soccer field. It defines a mode of play. The field defines a context for everyone who agrees to play soccer. It defines what kind of ball you can use, what you can do with the ball, the number of players in the field, and what those players can do on that field. It's a set of rules. And if you don't follow those rules, you get an error, a penalty flag. Again, people don't like that. So, in stark contrast to modes, or modal, is modelessness. It's an awful word. Modelessness is all actions should be available at all times to all people to do anything they want. So you've heard of WYSIWYG? Well, this is kind of like what you do is what happens. There is no limitation on these interfaces. You're free to get about the cabin and do whatever you want. It sounds awesome. It's liberating. And sure enough, modelessness is better than modal, runs the industry mantra. It's all about designing modelessness in your interfaces. So to make this simple, as the number of modes decreases, the system approaches modelessness. Problem is, this isn't ideal. You cannot create a modeless interface. It doesn't exist. It's a vain effort. It's an amazing design goal, though. And let me show you why. It inspired this. I think Peter Mee's talk, I don't know if he's here or not, but basically he talked about how the iPod, the Peter Mee law is this iPod, is always used as an example to talk about simplicity increasingly. So here's my use of the iPod. The iPod is an approach towards modelessness. It's far down that spectrum. It only has two modes, play and browse. So when you're using the interface, when you're gesturing on that circle, you're navigating trees all the way down, right? Menu, 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 menu. You hit OK and you start playing, and then when you start engaging the click wheel again, what happens? You're changing the volume. You have shifted modes. If you press the OK button again, you don't select something else, you actually change the state of what the click wheel does. Now it's a rating, now it's a fast forward. So those are two main modes of the iPod, browse and play. In order to achieve this, it had to be radically, fundamentally constrained. Of course, you still run into mode errors, right? Here's a great example. I find something I'm listening, I want to listen to, I start listening to it. I browse back up, I'm trying to find something, and then another song comes on that playlist that's been playing, and it's too loud, or I want to skip it, or I want to turn it down, and I start using the scroll wheel to change the volume, right? But it's actually not going to change the volume. It's going to keep navigating me in the list that I'm in. That's a mode error, essentially, because it doesn't do what I would like it to do. Brenda Laurel had a great acronym to describe that problem. It's called NFI. It stands for no fucking interface. And she used it as a design requirement to talk about augmented reality virtual spaces, heads-up displays, so that when you were in the world in this far-out future of ours, you wouldn't be seeing buttons in front of people's faces, that you would actually be able to encounter them much like I am with you in the real world. So NFI is basically modelessness. It's basically get rid of it all, and it doesn't make any sense. But it's a great approach. It's a great way to design, to think about reducing the number of modes as possible. So until then, until we enter the metaverse, there's supermodality. So supermodality does its own approach to modelessness. And so to wrap up the field metaphor, this is kind of like supermodality. It's lots of modes, but imagine there weren't walls here. Imagine that you could actually begin dribbling out of bounds on one field and find yourself scoring a touchdown on another. That's supermodal, and it's weird. And it should feel weird. My colleague, Dr. Scott Nazarian at Frog, coined the term supermodality, and he borrowed it from material sciences, where we have things called superfluids. If you've ever seen superfluids, they're a form of liquid that essentially, at extremely cold temperatures, will slide up outside of the vessel and onto the table. It's a very weird property of matter that exists at extremely low temperatures. The extremes that we're talking about here, though, are not about temperature. They're about choice. They're about infinite choice and the fact that networked media gives you infinite choice. And so supermodality is a way of designing, of moving through that infinite choice. So I'm going to show you a movie. It's 2 minutes long. I'm not going to speak for a while. And it should be something which gives even better example of what supermodality is. It's a demo of a game called Half-Life Portal. And this is a real game.
Welcome to the Aperture Science Enrichment Center. Let's look at some of the challenges you'll face as a test participant. You may be required to perform simple tasks, such as locating an exit. These simple tasks may be supplemented with insurmountable obstacles. Thanks to the Aperture Science handheld portal device, the impossible is easy. Let's look at a real-world example. Certain objects may be vital to your success. If at first you don't succeed, you fail, and the test will be terminated. Wensta, remember our motto, there's a hole in the sky through which things can fly. At the Enrichment Center, we believe that a highly motivated test subject can carry out rather complex tasks while enduring the most intense pain. So in case you don't make it through the testing, goodbye. This next test is impossible. Now you're thinking with portals.
So many designers have compared interfaces to mazes. WIMPs are like 2D mazes. ZUIs are like 3D mazes. Most first-person shooters are ZUIs. They have perspective. They're just that much harder. So in WIMPs, there's doors in windows, right? So you're in a screen, and you can see something else that you can affect, and so you go and you bring it to focus. In 3D, there's doors on ceilings and floors. There's doors everywhere. And the super modalities, there's doors from anywhere to anywhere to anywhere to anywhere. That demo feels a little odd because you're doing things that the mind can't really conceive of because we have basically folded space. All right, that's what supermodality is. It's like wormholes and kind of black hole science fiction stuff, right? Or maybe they're real, I don't know. It's essentially, if you want to take anything away from this this talk, supermodality, so you can tell your friends, it's hyperlinking an interface. It allows you to move from one mode to another based on the context. So margins are supermodal. Selecting an item from a margin seeds the grid behind it, the mode behind it, with what I choose in that margin. That is, the specific place I show up in that grid is completely determined by what I choose in that margin. The choice I make determines my next state. The media card is extremely supermodal. I can go left and tunnel into the save mode, bypassing most of the interface, or I can go right and tunnel into the recommendations mode. Again, picking up the metadata that I had with me in the video object and porting it over to that grid, and then it determining what I will see inside of that grid. So, wrapping up, supermodality is a construct of experience design that sits above GUIs, ZUIs, and WIMPs. It's a way to design interfaces for today, for the always-on, hyper-connected, 21st century world of interlinking. It's surfing the internet on your TV. And that's the holy grail. That's what keeps TV in the box, relevant, and competitive with Web 2.0 video networks. Because this is the state of TV on the box today. This is not a metaphor. This is actually an employee from Verizon using a garden hose in the backyard of a customer's home to douse an electrical fire that was started by his crew during the installation of a fiber optic cable. This is happening all the time. This is the largest construction project in Verizon's history. It's $1 billion, to install a massive video and data network. This is what infinite choice looks like right now to the people who do TV on the box. But they have to do it because this kind of TV is over, and this kind of TV is starting. And so they have a choice. We all have a choice. Either it's TV on the left, Web 2.0 video networks, two-foot UIs, or TV on the right, TV as we know it. And which one of those two possible futures is up to us? Because there won't be a choice if we don't design it. And TV, as we know it, will be gone. Thank you. So I actually have 12 minutes left, so questions, please.
Can you talk about user testing that you did and are continuing to do with the OpenTV platform, both in terms of the process and how you structure it and some of the interesting insights from a very different approach to interfaces?
Absolutely. So when we first designed the interface that I showed you here, we did no user testing. It was just a demo to explain a lot of the concepts that we were thinking about. We then took it into two rounds of participatory design testing, right? So bringing users in and asking them to construct the interface that they would like to see before showing them this demo, and then showing them the demo, and then actually getting feedback on their opinions, basically, of how it mapped to their expectations of what a television of the future might look like. In terms of insights, what we found is that as designers, we were overly ambitious, specifically with things like the 3D rotating cube and, excuse me, a lot of the detail of the interface was just kind of getting in the way. So what we ended up doing was actually radically simplifying the interface. And what kind of came out of that was really focusing on the media itself as the affordance for control. So not doing icons, not doing a lot of text, not doing any buttons or checkboxes, right? But really saying, this is Zoolander because it looks like Zoolander, and so we're going to show it to you as Zoolander, and when you select it, you'll be watching Zoolander. There are no questions in the user's mind. So the process of refinement has been largely about reducing down that kind of interface clutter that you see in the demo as it stands right now.
So I'm struck by the extent to which the requirements for metadata to not just be in the landscape but also be carried with the user is critical. And so I guess my question is, how do you foresee... Do you foresee an industry of standards development around metadata and a whole industry of metadata generation? And how do you foresee the need to trail metadata with you, tying into things like OpenID and all those things online? And how do you see the privacy aspects playing out?
It's 10 questions. I really enjoyed meeting some of the Freebase people, just because I think they're definitely on that path towards trying to create some kind of open architecture for metadata like this. There's lots of ways to go about it. There's lots of partnerships out there, lots of services that consolidate metadata, and more importantly, normalize it so that it's actually all usable from within any interface or any application. So I actually have good hopes for metadata synchronization happening. In short term, we'll have to use some very crude tools like web scraping to get some of that out, some massive web scraping projects, user community, so uploading tags, things like that, and look to that community for a lot of the work. So crowdsourcing is another way to do it. Mm-hmm. As to the privacy, you know, that's something we asked in our user testing as well, was a lot about privacy. Specifically, the idea of generating profiles and making them explicit versus implicit. And, you know, yes, it's an issue. People have a sense of TV as being a kind of a protected space. And it's hard to move into the interactive era without challenging that assumption. Your web browser wouldn't be anywhere near as successful as it is if it didn't know a little bit about who you are. And so that's one of the things going forward with this design, is trying to figure out the explicitness of privacy controls. I think TiVo's actually done a pretty good job when you set up, telling you basically, you know, hey, listen, it's your choice. Either get, you know, results from it or not based on you saying yes or no to this privacy question.
My question is on haptics. And there's a company called Sensible Technologies. Do you know them at all? They have a device, and granted, it's expensive, and it's. But I'm wondering what you see haptics. It's actually taking your four-way thing a little bit long, stronger. As a programmer, you program in force fields in the system. Have you done anything with that kind of thing yet?
So I love haptics. Who doesn't, right? It's like the next state of where we're all headed. It's a lot more resolution of the human experience being brought to interface design. So to that end, yes, let's bring it on. But the goal of this program was really to look across an international market and work within the constraints of the value chain. So most network service operators and even set-top box manufacturers don't really get to choose the remote control that ships with it, right? It's kind of OEM, ODM, and so sure. To that end, we did have to look for the lowest common denominator solution. We did a whole bunch of international research, India, the UK, Japan, and basically through all that found that in both developed and developing nations, the four-way control was just the lowest common denominator we could use.
I work for a telecommunication company, and we're developing an IPTV product. And sadly, they're thinking about bridging the gap between internet and TV is bringing a weather report on the TV, stock quotes, and
widgets.
Stuff like that, and widgets. And I'm wondering if you faced that as well, and if you discarded completely, or if you, because we haven't seen it, but I was wondering what are your thoughts on
that? So just to be clear, discarded what exactly? Just weather, or just...
Discarded... those widgets or...
Yes, absolutely. The fact that was where this project began when OpenTV started it out was in designing widgets for television, just like you're talking about. And the problem with widgets is that they're essentially Windows, and Windows demand pointers, and it's WIMP just kind of glossed up and prettified, and so we basically said, no, you're designing a WIMP. So let's move you out of that. It was an absolute discard. Which is not to say that the data services, the feeds of things like weather and news can't be incorporated in here. And in fact, that's something that we're working on for this next demo at NAB. So you'll see how that happens.
Great.
Yeah.
How do you handle the case where you said, like, the user knows Zoolander, they're looking at Zoolander, they know what it is, in the case of content they haven't seen or they don't know that they're getting pushed or recommended? Like, how do they understand what they're looking at if there's no text context around that?
Yeah.
And another question is, for profiles, do you guys set up a way to have, like, different profiles selected when a user watches TV? So if your kid watches TV, they're getting pushed cartoons versus you get pushed what you like?
Right. So I'll answer the second question first. The easiest way to think about profiles is that when you turn TV on, it asks you to log in, right? Which is the bane of most television UI designers, because it means TV doesn't work like we expect it to. That is, you turn it on and you start watching. So we're trying to handle the problem of auto profile selection based upon the patterns and habits that you use when you watch TV. So we're doing some research into that to see if that's something which can sort of auto-detect profile and then go back in time and change the data accordingly. But it may come down to the fact that we might have to argue for a user button on the remote control, which is actually something a lot of telcos and cable companies are providing. And it's a user button basically brings up that list of who you want to log in. So again, it's like privacy. It's one of those things where you get benefit if you choose to participate and make a user profile. And then if you don't, then you're just aggregated into the household. And what was the first part of your question? Right. So the answer, because that's a question that came up quite often, right, when you use the sort of direct media approach, these direct affordances as the media elements themselves. It came up a lot, and the answer is, well, how do you do it now? You channel surf. And so you stick there for a little bit, and you watch it, and you determine if you want to kind of bail or, you know, continue watching. And so what we intend to do by employing the back button, the up, left, right, in the way that we did, is make it so easy to move between those interfaces that the decision, the choice, the anxiety, the paradox of choice is so low that you'll go ahead and watch it if it seems even remotely interesting. You also have the info card as another contextual layer to bring up, which does, again, it's modal, it does interrupt your flow, but if you absolutely want to know what's going, you know, what else is that, about that data, then you can take a look at that.
Hi. I've got three questions, two rhetorical and one genuine. One is, doesn't this interface apply equally to web-based media and it's not all about the set-top box? Can't we see a ZUI for things like YouTube? The second rhetorical question is, what are the implications of the Wiimote for this? Mm. It seems like the D-pad isn't all that, even though the Wiimote has one. Mm-hmm. And the third genuine question is about liveness in TV, which seems to be the fundamental thing which draws me back to the box from time to time, even though I don't own one. Is, you know, event-based television and live-based television. You were replaying a sports game there. It said live in the corner, and it really wasn't. And I wonder what you think should happen about that.
You got a good eye. There's a lot of actually errors like that with bad watermarks being on the channels. So I'll answer your third question first, and you'll have to help me remember the first two. The live and non-live, or as I was calling it, linear and non-linear, right? TV based in time and that not based in time, is the central problem afflicting designing user interfaces, because the two are opposite each other. The way they operate in our heads, the way they operate in terms of people who provide that content. And so what this system has tried to do is essentially segment time, all time-based media, into one grid, and instead to really focus on the interactions between the other grids, the other types of nonlinear content. In fact, my argument goes that what we're going to see is less and less and less live TV as these sort of networked PVRs and great internets in the sky kind of become available, and that infinite archive is up. And the only thing that's going to be live are really events, right? That's sort of the logical end of this whole TV live TV system. And so we'll always need some kind of mode for viewing live TV, but I think the gradient is basically reducing on its need. And then your second question was around, I think, the Wii. So the Wii is interesting because it is a pointing device for TV. And if you look at what they have to design for, it's still a 10-foot UI because the affordances still have to be rather large to actually affect the hit target. And so you're still dealing with the same problems. That is, you don't see anybody moving windows around on the Wii or closed boxes, right? It's all about these very large, gushy buttons. And so to that end, it's certainly an approach to solving the TV UI problem. Again, I didn't see gestures, even though an accelerometer is very cheap, gestures in the way that Wii employs them becoming mainstream across, especially in an international market. And so like I answered the previous question, it was about lowest common denominator design, something that can actually get out to the market. Because a lot of what we design for at Frog have to play in a very complex ecosystem, right? So we can't determine like Apple or TiVo or Nintendo basically all the parts of the service. And so to that end, it had to be something that's, you know, doable. And then actually your first point's really interesting. I mean, that may have been the rhetorical question, but I chose specifically not to say that ZUIs and this kind of model are applicable for the web because I don't know if they are, but I agree with you. I suspect there's a lot that can be ported over. And I think I'm going to wait until a project comes up that really challenges that before I say with any certainty the way I feel about TV.
First off, I thought it was fantastic. Looked great. Can't wait to have it in my living room. But besides that, it seems like you're setting up a very specific paradigm and you're extending the hand through the remote as to up, down, left, right, north, south, east, west.
Right.
What do you do when there is this fifth thing to do that becomes as important?
Right.
You know, because at that point, that programming that the person has to be rethought of.
Yeah. So that's one of the reasons that I tried to make clear in Supermodality that it's all about ridiculously constrained interface design.
Mm-hmm.
We have a habit as designers and just product companies in general of feature creep, adding features. N plus one design, right? It's never about taking away. And I like to take a different approach. Rather than saying, what features can I add to my product to make it better, let's do a square root on what we have. Let's get to the root of what the actual features should be doing and rethink the interface. And if you look at the emergence of Apple's iPod, you'll see they've been rethinking the interface time and time again, actually changing conventions on us. Now, they didn't mess with a central browse mode, right, the trees. But what was happening on the fringes of those trees and how the play mode worked actually has changed quite a lot since generation one. And so our approach to solving that problem is to say, well, at root, you're going to have four grids. You're going to have up, down, left, right, and we're going to redefine the interface when we need to incorporate more features, essentially.
So if priority or importance or this new way of browsing becomes prevalent, it may be something you would replace as opposed to adding something additional?
That's correct. And this has already happened. After we did industry and customer feedback, we got a lot of requests for certain features that didn't fit neatly into this model of up, down, left, and right. And so we did have to basically refactor the design to account for those. The other solution that's on the table is to create a modular design for the network service operators so that they can basically mix and match which pieces they want. So if they want you to have basically the all advertising grid, then they'll put that in there. And trust me, that's been high on the list. So it's really a question of intent and who's in control, whether we give to the user, the network service operator, or the application just has it built into its limits.
If there's time for another question, you mentioned search as being something that's going to be integrated.
Mm.
What's the interface solution using the remote control for that?
I can't show you. Sorry. It'll be awesome. I promise that. Come to NAB or find me maybe in the hallways, but I just can't show that right now. Thank you.